In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
We told you back in January that this year we are going to be taking a deeper look at leftist ideology, especially since socialist thinking has come out into the light, like some vampire no longer afraid of the sun. We've seen the theft of an election. We've seen the Supreme Court refuse to look at clear and compelling evidence. That's the kind of thing that happens in leftist countries. We have seen conservatives be attacked in the media like never before, especially Trump supporters, as though they are all racist and hostile to America, which is an odd position to take when the slogan is, "Make America Great Again." We've seen the President of the United States vilified, accused of inspiring violence, and then kicked off social media so he couldn't defend himself. We have stepped through the looking glass and are into full-blown, open, in-the-daylight Marxist attacks on America from every angle. You know, it used to be that liberals embraced individuality and free speech and independent thought, and I think liberals in the traditional vein still do. But now, with progressives largely taking over that political space that the liberals used to occupy and displacing them, now you're not only not allowed to think independently, they will ban you from the public discourse if you don't subscribe to the current groupthink or government think. Independent thought is not allowed. You must conform. You must believe what the government tells you. When you think about it, why are we demanding vaccines anyway for a disease that has, on average, a 99.9% survival rate? Vaccines that only have an 87% or 67% effectiveness rate. Has anyone stopped to think about that? Probably. But they're also probably banned for thinking that, especially if they actually say it. It really is rather amazing that with the tens and hundreds of billions of dollars that the left has siphoned off of public funds and millions more that mega billionaires donate, it's amazing that the left still hasn't managed to win the hearts and minds of people. I think it's because the left just doesn't understand human nature. The right leads by example and attracts people to it because it's a better way of doing things. And they see it as you're free to make up your own mind and make your own choice whether or not to adopt that way. The left leads by imposing their rules and views on others, and you have no rights to say no. And if you do say no, you'll be punished. It's freedom versus mental slavery. Project 21 has been a leading voice of black conservatives for over 25 years and is sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research. I'd like to welcome back one of their members, Nadra Enzi, who is also a motivator for patriots seeking extra encouragement. He's a writer, blogger, and grassroots security consultant with decades of experience. Nadra, it is great to talk to you again.
Hello, fellow freedom fighters.
You know, we wanted to have you back on because last time we just didn't get into some of your areas of expertise, among them being a public safety advocate. And this is a big thing for those of us out here in the Pacific Northwest with Portland and Seattle and the mess that they've become. In the wake of Antifa riots last summer, the Oregon State Police actually pulled out of Portland at a time when that they were needed the most because the district attorney there in Multnomah County decided not to prosecute crime. The state police released a statement that said, quote, "At this time, we are inclined to move our resources to counties where prosecution of criminal conduct is still a priority." And this seems to be one half of growing trends, not only in Portland, but other Democrat-led cities, to not actually punish crimes, and the other half being to defend police. Let's start with that first half, though. I assume you'd agree with your background that not punishing crime is most definitely not the answer to solving crime and safer communities. But I am curious, though, what, if anything, do you hear from people on the other side of this issue as to why they think not punishing crimes will somehow make communities safer?
Well, they feel mistakenly so, that the First Amendment includes what normally would be considered vandalism, rioting, interstate conspiracies to commit vandalism and rioting, destruction of government property, assault on law enforcement officers, etc., etc., ad infinitum. They consider this to be protected speech, and increasingly, progressive DAs, mayors, county commissioners, governors, perhaps even the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, have a very ideologically driven definition of speech. Now, when you choose ideology over safety, then clearly you get situations like what we have now. If you have a city where people are not being prosecuted, or a county, a jurisdiction where, regardless of what they do, if it's considered to be a, quote, demonstration, in quotes, they're not going to be prosecuted. If your state police and other partner agencies do not subscribe to that theory, you now have left not a defunded, but a defamed and defamed local police department to face politically enabled criminals whom your state assets said, we can't back you up because we take all the risks, we do all the heavy lifting, and the progressive prosecutor for your county says he's not going to prosecute you. And you have a local police department that is being told by a mayor, we don't want you to enforce the law in these areas. So whether it's autonomous zones, the perpetual rioting and siege of a federal courthouse in Portland,
yeah,
the ongoing saga of infrastructure implosion in Seattle, this is what we're seeing when people choose ideology over safety.
Yep. You have a really great article that we'll link up on iSpy Radio. It's called Defunding Police Defeats Public Safety, Especially in Black Communities. And in it, you say that the critics of police and safety citizens such as yourself had hoped that community policing efforts, with its focus on relationship building, would be the solution to tensions between police and urban communities. But it has fallen short and, in fact, has led to the opposite, calling for diminished police powers and even abolishing the police altogether. Why do you think those community police efforts failed if they are so focused on relationships?
Again, ideology over safety. The voices you don't hear from progressive prosecutors, their counterparts in City Hall, and definitely their peers in local and even national corporate media, are the Black Neighborhood Association members who want more police, not less police, more prosecution, not less prosecution, because they are on the front lines. And no amount of ideology undoes the damage to property, the loss of life, and the injury that they experienced. But their voices, and voices like mine, except for platforms like yours, thank you very much, are frozen out of the conversation. We don't fit the narrative. We don't subscribe to the ideology. So our losses, material and human, are just considered collateral damage. I'm speaking to you from New Orleans, Louisiana. Last weekend, we had four teens shot in one weekend.
Wow.
And it wasn't by the police. And it wasn't by the Proud Boys. And it wasn't by the GOP. Nothing. In the city that has had, in the last election cycle, possibly 30 to 50 marches about how much certain lives matter. But you're getting kids shot down in the street. There's still an unsolved murder of a 9-year-old who was shot in the head and killed last year.
Wow.
Again, ideology, if it does not fit the narrative of a certain ideology, then it receives no media attention, and sadly, the progressives in office, no political attention.
No, and that never solves any problems at all. Let's go and take a break there. Come back, we'll have more on public safety and what can and should be done with Project 21 member Nadra Enzi. Stay with us. And welcome back. Nadra Enzi is an outspoken anti-crime activist in New Orleans for over two decades and an advocate for increased community involvement in the cause of public safety. He's also a member of Project 21, a leading voice of Black conservatives for over 25 years, which is sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research. And so, Nadra, in that last segment there, we were talking about an article that you had, Defunding Police Defeats Public Safety, Especially in Black Communities. And I'm going to make sure that we put that up on iSpyRadio.com. And but there was also this, though, and this was from your bio on Project 21. It says, Enzi has added that crimes and strained race relations can be remedied by a boots-on-the-ground approach to taking on burglars, bullies and criminals. What did you mean by that, the boots on the ground?
Meaning that instead of viewing urban police and the urban public as two enemies who shall never meet, working together with safety advocates, neighborhood associations, business owners, concerned citizens who live or work or commute in these areas, boots on the ground is a euphemism for real community police partnerships. And I do actually patrol my neighborhood. I give out gift cards to the local subway for our homeless. I keep an eye out. I escort crime victims. Do whatever I can within the law and my comfort zone to provide a bridge between the public that wants policing and the police who want to try and engage the public. And it has to be boots on the ground because, unfortunately, I've yet to see this type of connectivity happen when someone is in an office suite blocks of miles away from the urban center in question. You know, it's got to be stakeholder relations. It's got to be public police partnerships where the problems are happening.
In that last segment, you had mentioned that so much of tearing down the police and defunding them and all the rest is based more on ideology than anything else. As you interact with some of those people that want to do that, what is it, though, that they hope to replace it the police with, and how would it be any better?
Well, again, clearly through an ideological lens, and I would say a somewhat delusional ideological lens, they feel that depowered police, diminished policing, and policing the place with, which I can agree with, but not the way they promote, with civilian specialists, is somehow going to lead to a reduction in use of force on suspects, an improvement of relations between, we'll say, the authorities and communities where relationships have been toxic, but we're not seeing that. In the cities where we see autonomous zones where the police withdraw and let people do their thing, we see assault, we even see murder. And ironically, but not so surprisingly, calls from service from the very autonomous cities whose narrative is they don't want police until they get in trouble. So I think that instead of police reform, there needs to be more focus on reforming the advocates who are calling for police reform. Because when they get what they want, they don't like what it is because everybody doesn't subscribe to this ideology. So when someone decides to hit you over the head, you didn't anticipate that because you thought, well, removing the big, bad boys and girls in blue was going to make everybody play nicely in the sandbox. And sadly, that's just not the case. You know, in the absence of self-governance, government has to come in by proxy. And those proxies are our law enforcement officers.
Yeah. Well, it would be nice if everybody just managed to get along. And of course, that's just not real life. And yeah, in these areas that do have higher crime and whatnot, you know, we've talked with Burgess Owens a number of times, and he has often spoke out about the victim mentality, which in his view is pervasive among Black Americans. And I noticed in your bio that you say something pretty similar to that. You say, quote, law-abiding folks have been conned into thinking we're hostages who have to stay on our knees to street thugs and indifferent bureaucrats. And, you know, taking yours and Burgess's thoughts into account, is that one reason why crime happens more in some of these minority areas, that they've been conditioned to being victims and that there's just nothing they can do about the crime, so they effectively tolerate it or, even worse, turn to a life of crime themselves?
Well, and again, to be compared with Burgess Owens, high compliment indeed. Sadly, when your levers of media and local governments are controlled by ideologues, the very people who call 911, who go to neighborhood meetings, who go to police community council meetings, and question police officers and decision makers on why weren't people arrested. Case in point, we had a guy last year whose recreational activity is punching women in the face. Our city council, in their finite wisdom, decided that misdemeanor assault, which this is, unfortunately. Now, the last woman I talked to that he hit got had a concussion, but it's misdemeanor assault. So he was being given summonses to go to court instead of being arrested. They know him. They know where he lives. He's attacked numerous women. Finally, he picked on the wrong woman, a friend of ours, and gave her dog a concussion because he kicked the dog. Well, between her going to local media and a lot of us in the community lobbying with the local DA's office and the police, he was finally arrested. And lo and behold, he was actually already supposed to have been arrested because he had an active probation violation warrant because he wasn't going to see his probation officer, as well as other warrants. This is what passes for, quote, public safety, when you put ideology before safety. People are being told that regardless of how you feel, or even regardless of what local ordinances and state law says, that your police and your prosecutors are being told, don't arrest and don't prosecute. So the people who actually want more police, and the coalition I formed includes a whole bunch of Bernie voters. And like I told them, don't change your beliefs, but change your tactics. When it gets to the point that even Bernie voters are tired of being beaten up and robbed, then you realize that there's a limit to how much people can really take when it comes to placing ideology over safety.
Yep. Ideology, you know, it always sounds good, but it just means a lot of times that nothing ever gets done. Coming up, for someone who said he wanted to heal racial divisions, the Biden administration is instead creating more racial tensions than ever. They recently announced that they would push ahead with reparations and not wait for Congress. We'll talk about that next with Nadja Enzi, member of Project 21. And welcome back. We're talking with Nadja Enzi, a member of Project 21, the leading voice for Black conservatives for over 25 years. That is a program of the National Center for Public Policy and Research. Nadja, in this last segment with you, I'd like to get your thoughts on reparations. Just the news reported a recent poll found 60% of Americans are against reparations, while less than one-third, only 31%, are actually in favor. In fact, 43% are strongly opposed to this. However, as I said, going out of that last break there, a senior White House advisor said that the Biden administration is pushing ahead with this regardless of what Congress does or what the public thinks. And I guess, you know, if you've got $1.9 trillion burning a hole in your pocket, you can dish out a whole lot of cash to constituencies. So what are your overall thoughts on reparations?
I think it's a gimmick, and I'm using a direct quote from, ironically, a local congressional candidate who is running for the seat that was formerly held by the senior advisor for the White House who just mentioned. I mean, again, in the constant pursuit of ideology and energizing parts of their coalition, they're presenting reparations. The president is a former senator, a very long tenure. I think he knows that it's going to be buried, essentially, in Congress by some Democrats and definitely by a number of Republicans. He'll be able to engineer a crisis, hold his hands up looking blameless, and then use it as yet another get-out-the-vote opportunity for the midterm, and I would assume for re-election. It's very cynical, and the only upside I see to it is that I want the Democratic Party to finally have to put up and shut up, on the issue of reparations, because it's a talking point. I don't think that they legitimately think that they're going to pass reparations. And for the advocates of reparations, I would warn them, if it does pass, I promise you it will not bear any resemblance to what you want. It will only be to advance narrow partisan interest and not broad concern, you know, legitimate or otherwise.
You know, there was a CMDC article in August of last year, and fascinating article in the sense that it said to finally heal the racial divide that, quote, a meaningful program to eliminate the existing black-white wealth gap would cost between $10 and 12
$1 trillion, or about $800,000 to each eligible black household. You know, I'm sitting there trying to imagine how that would go over if someone's black neighbor who was never a slave was handed $800,000, while the white neighbor who never owned a slave can't even go back to work because of government lockdowns. I just have a hard time seeing that fixing racial relations.
And once again, outside of the bubble of cynical politicking, these are some of the very harsh realities of these that these particular policy prescriptions are going to impose. I think that it's not about broad relief for real and imagined historic issues. It's only about narrow partisan interest. I don't think they really anticipated even passing the Senate. And even if the president signs an executive order, once again, what form will it be in? Where will the money come from? You know, none of these questions are being offered. None of the answers to these questions are being offered by the administration. So you're going to deepen divides, and you're going to hopefully use this once again for cynical get out the vote for the midterm and for reelection. I mean, it's really sad.
Oh, it's terribly sad. And like I said, I think this would make racial relations even worse than they already are. What is the thoughts within the black community, though, about reparations? Do they think that something needs to be done, or do they see it for what it is? It's just, you know, a means to get black vote support. I mean, what are their thoughts?
I mean, there's a growing consensus among, we'll say, from the more black nationalist to the leftist center of the community about reparations. For a lot of people who are trying to, one, reopen their businesses or reclaim their jobs after these shutdowns, reparations seems to be as fanciful as their prospects for really even being able to reenter the workforce right now. But it is a vocal issue. I want to see the Democrats placed in a position where they put up a shut up, because they're giving people false hope. They're going to present this. There's going to be a magic impasse of probably moderate to conservative Democrats and definitely the majority of Republicans. And then they're going to say, well, see, we tried, but if you reelect us next time, we'll do better. And they'll just keep dangling this carrot in front of people. Cynical,
yeah.
Manipulative, and playing with very raw wounds in the American body politic.
Yeah, and that right there, I think, is it. These are very raw wounds, and for having some politician play with them, I think it's just absolutely reprehensible. You know, one of the things that really bothers me in all of this is the idea of reparations. It paints all blacks as victims and all whites as abusers. You know, there's never any acknowledgement that I have ever seen within the discussions of reparations is, you know, maybe we should do something for all of those white Republicans who fought and died on the Union side to free the slaves. I mean, we're only, it seems like with all of these solutions, they're only ever looking at one side of the equation.
Well, again, when you put on the type of ideological lens that they have, it's never looking at the whole in its constituent parts. Mm-hmm. It's how do I benefit this one half to the exclusion of the other half?
Yes.
And for all these woke folks running around, if the bill comes due, if it means that they have to suffer some economic deprivation, some additional taxation, then we'll see how woke the woke really are on this issue. Again, it's something that is best left untouched, but we're dealing with ideological zealots, so they're hoping to benefit from it. They're going to move forward with it, and we are going to have to stand by and see exactly where this goes and what we can do about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I think it is narrow partisan politics and not a solution for broad, real, and imagined redress.
No. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Nadja Enzi, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to having you back.
Absolutely.
It's not just a show, it's self-defense.
And welcome back. If you're just joining us, you just missed Nadja Enzi. He's a member of Project 21, which is a leading voice for black conservatives for over 25 years and is a program of the National Center for Public Policy Research. I'd like to welcome now David Ridenour to the show, who is the president of that parent organization. David, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you, especially those who are located in Oregon.
Yes, that's for sure. So, you know, and we'll get to that in a second. You know, I'd really like to compliment you on your organization and its projects. We first came across your organization a couple months back with Free Enterprise Project and Justin Danhof, and we could just tell you guys were going to be a great fit for us. And we feel like we've just really barely scratched the surface of what you guys are out there doing to defend liberty and personal responsibility. I mean, these are the very foundations of the American way of life, which is always under attack every day, but especially so these days, and not only from political parties, but big tech, big medicine, and the media itself. So hats off to you guys on such a terrific organization.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all you do to spread the word. The National Center was set up to be a little bit different. We figured that you couldn't solve a problem by writing a paper about it. So most of our programs are focused on real action, things that we can do. Free Enterprise Project, for example. We send people to shareholder meetings. We file shareholder resolutions. Yes. And of course, you know, Project 21 is fighting to bring more blacks into the conservative movement where they belong to build the conservative movement tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And talking of Free Enterprise Project and what you guys do there, we're scheduled to have one of your Justin Danhof back on to talk about a little bit of what happened there at Disney this last week. I mean, just crazy stuff. Before we really get into the meat of things, I see that you received a political science degree from the University of Oregon. Are you an Oregonian, or did you just go there for college, and which I'm guessing that was probably back in the late 70s, early 80s. What a different world Oregon was back then.
It was a different world. So I spent most of my youth in Oregon. I grew up in a small town, Eagle Point, which we used to describe as being five cow pastures outside of Medford. All those cow pastures are gone now.
Yeah.
But very conservative, small town, lots of ranches around our house. As a matter of fact, I worked my way through the University of Oregon by raising pigs and taking them to 4-H fair each year.
Wow.
So that's how I got my degree. But yeah, the university hasn't changed that much, but the state has.
Yeah.
The university had the Revolutionary Communist Youth Brigade chapter. So it was pretty radical. Wow. Even at that time. We used to call it Berkeley Northwest. but I started the College Republican Club there, and then I went on to start a state federation of college Republicans, starting up chapters all over the place.
Wow.
In the
wow.
state.
Wow. And it's still going, actually. So the National Center for Public Policy Research was founded in 1982 during the Reagan years as a conservative think tank. What were the reasons and the driving force behind starting the organization, especially when you had a conservative president in office at the time?
Well, because the conservative president needed an awful lot of help, especially on foreign policy. A lot of people forget that he faced a oppositional Congress, everything he had to work really hard at. And what he was talking about were some fairly radical things at the time. We don't think of them as that now, but large tax cuts. He got rid of the bracket creep by getting rid of the, by adding indexing to inflation to the tax code. And he took on the Soviet Empire.
Yes.
Head on.
Yes.
And that was enormously difficult to do. And he achieved it. He said he would put them on the ash heap of history, and darned it if he didn't do it.
Mm. Well, as you say, he was a huge anti-communist. But we know from Ian Pachepa, who was the head of the Soviet disinformation campaign, who defected to the U.S. in 1978, and from the research of people like Diana West, that agents of communism and socialism had already infiltrated the West, including into U.S. administrations, long before Reagan came to power. So the attacks on America today certainly aren't new. I mean, they've just really fully coalesced and come out into the light. And they're a lot better funded thanks to billions of taxpayer dollars that go to those Democrat-supported organizations. But back when you started, how was the far left pushing back against Reagan at that time? And did you have a sense of just how deep communism had already spread in the West?
Well, I mean, you may recall back then there was the Nuclear Freeze campaign. very well orchestrated, well funded campaign, they would bus people in from all over. And we were convinced that a lot of that was funded by the Soviet active measures. And our organization did counter demonstrations. As a matter of fact, we held one counter demonstration in which we had Eldridge Cleaver, former Black Panther. Nobody knew he had converted to conservatism, but he had fled to Cuba, saw what it was like in Cuba, and said, "No, I'd rather go to prison in the United States," and came back to the United States. And nobody knew he had converted, so we put him midway down in our schedule so that we were competing with the best. The media wasn't going to the best speakers of the other side, and we really dominated the media at that time. So it was a really, really good effort. It's always best to stick in those surprises when you can.
Yeah. We only got about a minute here with you in this segment here. If you had known then about where America was headed and would end up today, how would you have approached things differently back then?
Well, I think we would have done things the way we did them back then, but we would have worked even harder if that was possible. What has happened over the last several years, I couldn't believe would happen.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling and it's illogical where people, like in Portland, are willing to put up with their cities being shut down, there being violence in the city, and then returning those people to office. That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Last week we heard from Kimberly Herman that a new legal focus of the left is on fairness and equity. We'll talk about that next with David Ridenour. And welcome back. We're talking today to David Ridenour. He's the president of one of our new favorite organizations, the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about them by heading to nationalcenter.org and then dive into the different areas that they work on, which you can find under the Programs tab at the top. So, David, we talked last week with Kimberly Herman. She's the general counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation about their win in federal court to overrule the CDC's power grab that imposed the moratorium on evictions. And she had mentioned during that discussion that she was seeing a new focus of the left in terms of their legal approach, which is to impose or infuse, anyway, doctrines of fairness and equity. And it's it's not fair that you lost your job due to COVID and you can't or simply won't pay your rent. And my word's not hers. Why should you have to pay anyway? Because the landlord is so rich and it's only fair that you don't pay.
Right.
In terms of where all of this is going and in terms of socialist ideology, I don't think there's anywhere that this notion of fairness and equity is more apparent than in nationalized health care. And I know that you've done some work in this area. Back in 1990, you co-authored a book, Nicaragua's Continuing Revolution, and your wife wrote the 2009 book, Shattered Lives, 100 Victims of Government Healthcare. I mean, that's right on the heels of Obamacare there. So how are all these mechanisms interacting regarding where the far left wants to take the U.S. today, and why this focus on equity and fairness?
Well, they are all tied together. And even though there's a new emphasis on it, mainly because it's catching with the media and it's catching up with corporate America. But this is nothing new at all. You have to go back to the 1930s. In the 1930s, Marx and Engels saw or hoped to see revolution spread throughout the world, and it just didn't transpire. And one of the reasons it didn't transpire is because there were shared values from between the elite and the people that they governed. And so they just weren't able to get traction on that. And the founder of the Italian Communist Party, Antonio Gramsci, first put his thumb on it, which was in order for communism to succeed, they had to destroy the norms of society. And that's what we see is happening right now. That's why you have one population group pitted against another. And in the 1960s and 1970s, they realized that race was a very, very good motivator. And if we could focus on victimhood, both real and imagined, they could pursue their agenda. That's also why, you know, hear people talking about 31 different genders. There aren't 31 different genders. But if you can be part of an oppressed class, you will fight against the government. And that's mm-hmm. exactly what they want to do. And also, you know, in this scenario, by the way, there are no objective facts. Because this theory is about, because man is imperfect, there are no facts. And that's something that's really, really hard to fight against when the person you're debating is challenging, you know, legitimate facts as illegitimate because, you know, it's through the prism of race or whatever. Hard to win that battle.
Yeah.
But we've got to have it.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this notion of pushing through free healthcare and taking over the healthcare systems, I mean, to me, so much of it is centered around control. And one of our earliest guests on the iSpy radio show was Trevor Loudon, and he said it really well, and it has really stuck with us through all these years. Under free market healthcare, you're a customer. Under socialized medicine, right. you're a liability. And he says that because the government, you know, when the government is running your healthcare, they have actually a fiduciary responsibility to make sure you cost the government as little as possible. And that completely changes the dynamics of that normal market relationship. It's also why you see horrific things like these nursing home deaths, because under socialized medicine, old people are just expensive and therefore expendable. And it's why you hear heartless things like Cuomo saying, so what if they died in nursing homes? They still died. Well, it matters because you put them there where they were bound to infect others. You know, the government was making the decisions for them. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, what it does is it sets up the scenario, as you say, the government has all the control, but they also want to reduce the liability. So what socialized medicine is really, really good at is inoculations, checkups, all these kinds of things. What it's really, really bad at is organ transplants, heart bypass surgery. And that's why, you know, the only reason a lot of these socialist regimes are allowed to continue in healthcare, let's take Canada, for example, is because the United States has a free market system, or largely free system, where they can come and get their care. Canadians are coming down to the United States for heart surgery.
Yep.
I mean, large numbers of them, so much so that the government was actually paying for it because they didn't have the expertise there. You take a place like the United Kingdom, and my wife wrote that book that you mentioned. She co-authored that book. Excellent book. Had all sorts of stories about people who were waiting in line, and some got so frustrated with waiting in line that they took matters in their own hands. There's a story of a guy who was in severe pain because of dental problems. So, you know, what was his solution? He grabbed a bottle of vodka, drank it, grabbed some pliers, and pulled his teeth out.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And there's story after story after story like this. And then a lot of the cancer medications that we have here, because, you know, we have the cutting edge stuff here. In places like the United Kingdom, they don't offer them because they're too expensive. Mm. And that's not what we want.
No.
That's not what we want for America.
No, absolutely not.
You know, even if it's a matter of just extending a loved one's life for 2-3 months, it's worthwhile. I can say that from personal experience because my wife died several years ago from cancer. She went through 4 different chemotherapies, 4 different types, and she continued for 4 years with stage 4 cancer. That wouldn't have happened in other countries.
No.
She largely got to see her kids get through high school. And that's so important.
Yeah. Well, and that likely would not have happened under socialized medicine. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, 2 different worlds. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Dave Ridenour. He's the president of the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about them and their pro-America, pro-freedom programs by heading to nationalcenter.org. And we've been talking about the left's ideology, and it's really about control, which manifests itself in nationalized healthcare, socialized healthcare. And, you know, David, it's really amazing the two different worldviews at work. And in Biden's speech on Thursday night, hailing the triumphal passage of the COVID relief bill, which should be more aptly named the Democrat bailout bill, he talked about fighting COVID and the vaccines. And he said, slightly paraphrasing here, that if everyone submits and obeys government, then there's a chance you'll be allowed to celebrate Independence Day. That is just astounding. Submitting to an authoritative government that may or may not let you travel or even buy things in stores or go to church if you don't take the vaccine they're forcing on you, that's not my idea of independence.
No, and it's absolutely, absolutely chilling. And you saw what they did during COVID in a lot of states. Oregon, for example, California.
Yes, very much.
Closing down the churches. Mm-hmm. Remember, in the earlier segment, I was talking about the structures that you need to pull down in order for Marxism, Leninism to succeed. And the church is one of those. And a lot of
Absolutely.
Churches were prevented from meeting. And some of those churches will never be back. They'll never be back.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I was saying there, we've got really two different Americas, two very different approaches to healthcare and to life. And I really think it kind of explains why the left believes they must control others, because you can't have a world where half the world follows the health rules and get vaccinated like good little sheep, while the other half is out there infecting the world and spreading diseases. I mean, that rebellious half
right.
must be forced to obey.
Yes. Well, you know, I have a theory about this. I'll share it with you, which is liberals know themselves extremely well. And what they know about themselves is if somebody doesn't stop them from doing something bad, they're going to do something bad.
Hmm.
Conservatives, on the other hand, more grounded in ethics, would never do something that would harm someone else. So they don't see the point in the regulations. They believe that they can make the decisions on their own without the government telling them what to do at every step of the way. So that, you know, it's two completely different worldviews, in that one is everybody out there will do harm unless you stop them, versus the other, which says, you know, most people are fairly decent folks.
Yeah.
And we don't need all these regulations, and we can let them make some of their own decisions. It's kind of the difference between adulthood and childhood.
Yes, very much. Yeah.
There are the adults in the room, and then there are the children in the room.
Yeah.
And I like to think of us as the adults.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because we encourage not only individual thought, but also responsibility for when you do things. You know, if you're going to exercise your freedom, you need to be responsible in how you exercise that.
And that's exactly why we trust people to make their own decisions.
Exactly right. You know,
because we'll make those the right ones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking about healthcare and how it's really foundational. Well, socialized healthcare, I should say, is really foundational to the power of control. And it's interesting when you look at, you know, some people may say, well, that's just crazy. How does that work? Well, just look at what we talked about last week with the CDC's power grab. That if you think socialized healthcare isn't about control, just look at what they did, where they thought that they had the right to ordain that people couldn't be evicted if they don't pay rent. I mean, that has nothing to do with healthcare, and yet healthcare was the excuse that they used to intervene in private property.
It's truly incredible. There are people who just want to concentrate more and more and more power in the federal government, and they'll do it if we let them get away with it. So I think it's absolutely wonderful that they won this case, because it's very important.
Yes. Well, and in terms of power and control, I mean, all that you need to see where this is headed is now China has recently announced that they want the World Health Organization to let them, meaning China, run the global vaccine passport system. I mean, that's just frightening to think about that. You know, a lot of that $1.9 trillion...
They weren't running WHO to begin with?
Well, now they want to run the vaccine passport system. So, yeah, you'll have China tracking how where you go and also whether or not you're allowed to go. We've got about 2.5 minutes here with you. You know, a lot of that $1.9 trillion spending package will inevitably go to bail out Democrat states, which have massive debt thanks to massive public employee retirement plans. And billions upon billions more of that COVID relief is going to go instead to leftist think tanks and organizations to figure new ways to push even more leftist ideology. How do you guys there at the National Center for Public Policy Research, how do you fight back against that? And is anyone handing your organization $1 billion?
No, nobody's handing us $1 billion. But if it were government money, we wouldn't take it anyway.
There you go.
We believe that, like Thomas Jefferson said, that to compel somebody to pay for something that they don't believe in is abhorrent and evil. And we honestly believe that. So we were calling for way back then. We did a blueprint for addressing COVID-19 way back when. And what we were arguing for then is states that didn't open up consistent with the tiered approach that the president outlined, that they wouldn't be eligible for any federal funding because it was their choice. I mean, let's be realistic here. Reason why a lot of them were closing down was to tank the economy.
Yes, absolutely.
For purpose of influencing the election. And they shouldn't be rewarded for that. And the other thing is that we were advocating is that special federal courts be set up for takings. So, you know, when you go through and let's say you're the city of New York and you close down somebody's restaurant, that's a taking. The New York City government has taken it for public use, and you are owed just compensation. And so we thought that those double pressures would cause some of these state governments to open up a little bit. But unfortunately, those policies weren't adopted.
Yeah, that really is unfortunate. That is, I think, what should have happened and needs to still happen, actually. David, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today here on the iSpy Radio Show. We certainly hope you're at least a little wiser for having been here. One last time, both of our guests today are from the National Center for Public Policy. I cannot encourage you enough to go visit their website, nationalcenter.org. That's nationalcenter.org. Check out their programs. They are focused not just on thinking, but on doing. And while you're there, please consider supporting them. After all, you pay someone who mows your lawn, right? Then I hope you'll support someone who are out there fighting for your God-given rights. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.